Welcome to the first voyage of the Warships International Fleet Review podcast. And I'm Ian Ballantyne, editor of Warships magazine, and I'll be your host for this podcast. When you look at navies, past, present, and future, they're always evolving, they're always doing interesting and fascinating things, and they're always affecting the course of world affairs and what humanity gets up to. And that's what the podcast is about. And each time we will look at what's in the magazine and also touch on other topics related to it, hopefully have a bit of fun as well as look at the serious stuff. Hello, Peter. It's great to have you aboard for the inaugural voyage of this podcast. And I wonder if you could, first of all, tell listeners a little bit about yourself.
It's a great pleasure to be here, join you on this voyage. Peter Hoare, I have been the associate editor of the magazine for the last 20 plus years. Before that, I was in the Navy for a modest 38 years. And my last job was head of defense studies. And since then, I have been writing, researching about the Navy, its strategy and its history. And in particular, I have been the naval obituarist of the Daily Telegraph, where I have written more than 1.5 million words on naval officers, naval people, Wrens, Royal Marines, almost anybody with webbed feet. And I feel that I have written the history of the Navy in the 20th century through these obituaries.
And I bet among all those many people that you profiled and wrote about in your obituaries, not one of them was an alien visitor from outer space trespassing into naval exercises.
Not at all.
I must admit, Peter, that 23 years ago, when we started the magazine up and you and I started working on it together, I did not imagine that we'd ever have a story prominently displayed at the front of the August edition of the magazine that basically came under the label Ufology News, because it appears though most of us on planet Earth are skeptical about aliens, people in spaceships zooming around, and have looked at people who believe in all that stuff as if they're slightly mad, that there may be something in it, because the US Navy has recorded via various means, camera, infrared sensors, and using ships and aircraft, what appear to be UFOs zooming around and interfering in exercises off the east coast and west coast of the USA. And more than that, there's actually been a US government report on it, which gives it credence. And it doesn't actually say that they're aliens, and they now call them UAPs, which is a new thing, unidentified aerial phenomena. And they don't say that they are definitely aliens, and they're not sure if they might be the Chinese or the Americans. And actually, I don't think they're entirely sure. It isn't the Americans themselves doing it. So in your long career at sea in the Royal Navy, did you ever see any low-flying UFOs or UAPs coming to buzz a vessel you were on?
Personally, I have, in my career at sea, in my 38 years in the Navy, the Royal Navy, I've never seen a UFO, to my knowledge. There is a well-known incident in 1999, when a UFO was seen, not by one ship, but by many, and it was recorded. HMS Manchester, she was on exercise somewhere in the Atlantic, on a NATO exercise with other ships, and a UFO was seen, allegedly, by several hundred sailors.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've actually mentioned that in the piece by Usman Ansari. And the thing that is quite extraordinary about that story is that the logbook of whatever warship this was actually became a flying object itself, and allegedly was blown over the side into the sea.
It's an extraordinary story, which, if you believe in conspiracy theories, has conspiracy written all over it.
Yeah.
Because at the time, Lord Hill Norton, Admiral of the Fleet, Lord Hill Norton, was chairman of a House of Lords committee, which is looking into UFO sightings. And he'd heard privately from a sailor that HMS Manchester in, I think, February 1999 it was, he'd heard from a sailor that HMS Manchester had seen a UFO, and this had been recorded in the ship's logbook. Now, you have to imagine the ship's logbook is the most precious thing there is on board. It's written up in pencil so it can't leak or be smudged. And they're sent off month after month. They're crawled over by the staff for accuracies and reports and information. And then they're sent off to the archives and they're kept forever. You can go into the archives at Kew and you can look at logbooks, continuous record of logbooks, going back to the 1700s. And now, in February 1999, HMS Manchester sees a UFO, And incredibly, can you imagine the guy who had to tell this to Admiral of the Fleet, Lord Hillnorton, that that logbook, while the ship had been alongside, had been caught by a gust of wind and blown overboard. I mean, it is just extraordinary that such a thing should happen, that this particular logbook should go missing.
Yeah. I mean, a logbook, there's two things that I know about logbooks. I've seen one or two of them myself in the archives. One thing is that, A, they don't actually record very much. So presumably whoever had to write that entry would be at the direction of what the captain and would put in their UFO scene, you know, whenever it was, wherever it was, and that would be it. I mean, would they record any other detail? And actually, they're quite heavy as well. So the idea of it being blown over the side is even more extraordinary, because it would make quite a big splash unless it flew away aboard a flying saucer or something like that.
It would have been written up in pencil. You're quite right. The logbook contains positions and movements and unusual events. So, you know, a major evolution involving the ship, or if you sighted some strange object like a UFO, you might record, you know, a light bearing so-and-so, or light traveling, or ship crossing from left to right, or a light or something crossing from crossing across the horizon. You would certainly, that's a special event which would go into the logbook. And the captain may not have given the order directly, but certainly one of his officers would have been responsible for making that entry.
Not wishing to spend too much time on this, but is it quite extraordinary, do you think? There were no cameras trained on this object, whatever it was. I mean, the Americans were able to record the most recent ones using F-18 Hornets that were sent out from an American aircraft carrier off the west coast of the USA and closed with these amazing craft, which did quite incredible things in the way that they maneuvered and the speed they went. And also a ship, the USS Omaha, off, I think, the east coast, managed to record the UAP or UFO on cameras too. So is there not somewhere in the vaults, a bit like Steven Spielberg hiding the Ark of the Covenant in a giant warehouse, is there not a load of tapes somewhere of the Manchester UFO?
Not dating from February 1999, I don't suppose. And anyway, cameras aren't you'd only use a camera if you're tracking a radar target. You might have a target camera, so you wouldn't normally have cameras scanning the skies.
Okay.
I suppose there might be some recording of the radar trace, but hang on, it's winter. We're in the high north in high latitudes. The days are quite short and dark, and the cloud is low. Who knows what they saw? They saw something presumably below the level of the cloud, and it was bright. And it was aerial, and they didn't identify it.
Of course, these days with mobile phones, people have them. Even people at sea on warships sometimes are prone to recording things. So I suppose these days there might well be something that leaked out from some Matlow or somebody else that decided to put it on the internet. So maybe they wouldn't get away with just the excuse of the logbook blowing over the side, do you think?
Okay. Well, Lord Hillnorton was quite a brusque character. But his informant told him that they'd encountered this unidentified object during the exercise. So presumably there were several radars scanning the sky and must have seen it. That Manchester had the radar trace or saw this object, and so did other ships, including some men in a Norwegian ship. And the incident was openly discussed in the operations room and on the communications network. So here is, you know, several people from different nations seeing something. And as we said at the beginning there, Lord Hillnorton was absolutely flabbergasted to be told this logbook taken to the air itself and disappeared. I mean, extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. We'll never know. But we must keep watching the skies and the horizon to see if there's any more UAPs. Yeah. The thing that I find extraordinary about it is that for many years, people have derided anybody that was to suggest that there were any intruders from outer space flying around and interrupting naval exercises or landing and kidnapping people. But the evidence that now seems to be accruing from various things like infrared sensors and cameras seems to point to actual craft zooming around. And that's the quite amazing thing about it. So if we give credence to those camera shots or to the sensors and all the evidence that's been gathered, would you put your money on aliens, Russians, the Chinese, or the Americans just kind of doing a double bluff and actually testing their own forces?
I'm very skeptical about the whole idea. I find it difficult, however. If the universe is infinite, there must be more advanced societies than ours, and I wouldn't. It's not totally incredible that they might come and visitors or inspectors, the way that we might in some future centuries do something in another universe. But these modern phenomena, I suspect, is a combination of all the things you've suggested. The Americans doing a double bluff, the Russians or the Chinese. After all, you've only got to look at what the extent to which the Americans went with their stealth program in the early years. They built a secret hangar on the coast, on the West Coast, and their first stealth ship only ever went to sea at night. And nobody ever seen it until it was revealed after several years of development and several hundreds of millions of dollars of expenditure on research. So whether there might be some aerial object in the same kind of black program, I wouldn't be surprised if there was.
But going from one incredible vessel to another, what do you think to the idea of a new royal yacht? Because Odin are very distinguished and sometimes very sharp observer of naval affairs, our leader commentary writer, has not only suggested that he's changed his mind on the royal yacht, which he was opposed to at one stage, but also now thinks that there should be two of them. So what do you think to that?
Let's not call it a royal yacht even, but let's call it some kind of special national vessel. For a start, the Royal Yacht was not replaced because the costs of re-engineering her were almost the same as the costs of building a new yacht. And Odin has outlined how different governments of the left and the right, while initially supporting or at some stages supporting the replacement Royal Yacht, then changed their minds or declined to put their hands in their pockets. The Navy has always been in two minds about this. There's an elite group of officers, the Royal Yacht officers, who treated themselves and the yacht as very special. And I think there might even be a degree of resentment about it. There are developed plans, the so-called Catalan project, for a new yacht, which combines some kind of sail training with the trade exhibitions. It's a great idea. But again, I don't think the Navy actually wants to pay for it. And I think it would be a mistake if you asked the Navy to man it. I think it would be a much better idea if you gave it to the Royal Fleet Auxiliary or to some aspect of the Merchant Navy, and you could then man it with partly the naval crews, partly with youth crews, or whoever you wanted to take on board. At the same time, there's a very strong argument for us that Britain should have some kind of hospital ship, the kind of ship which could be used to deliver vaccines to Commonwealth islands in the West Indies. And I see no reason why the role of these two ships should not be combined. And in fact, the Royal Yacht Britannia was intended to be a hospital ship in wartime. And it was the failure to make her available, for example, for the Falklands War, which was a fatal nail in her coffin. All they had to do was paint her white and put a red cross on her side. And even if she'd only got as far as Freetown, which is the last place where they could have got heavy oil, she would have been a famous Falklands veteran, and her future and her replacement's future would have been secure. So now let's take the whole idea forward. We're going to have a ship which is dual-rolled as a national flagship and as a hospital ship. And yes, indeed, let's have two of them, because one of them might be out of action, one of them might be a trade negotiation, or I believe strongly our royal family deserve a mobile palace. It should be taking our head of state on foreign visits. But let's have two ships, so that one of them is always available for hospital services, and we can proudly send it to disasters, whether it's Ebola in West Africa or vaccinations in the West Indies. End of argument.
So we can't really blame Tony Blair for getting rid of it, though, can we? It was actually a whole process that went over many years of not knowing what to do and indecision and, as you say, the Falklands War and the lack of using the vessel sowing doubt in people's minds about the utility of it.
It's convenient for certain sectors of the press to blame Tony Blair for the tiring of the Royal Yacht. But no, you're quite right. He was only part of a whole process which led to her demise.
I remember when I was in Caen for the 60th anniversary of D-Day, I was aboard HMS Campbelltown, which was the first Sea Lord's flagship up the canal there. And on the same stretch of waterfront of the canal, just down from the British frigate was a Norwegian royal yacht that was, I think, even at that time, 100 years old. So some might say that Britannia was paid off while only halfway through her life. Would you agree with that?
That could be said. I've been on board the Norway myself, so I know the yacht you're talking about. The problem with the royal yacht is that she was steam-driven and she was dependent upon heavy oil, FFO, furnace fuel oil. It's a bit like running your car on tar. And because she was never re-engined, because the Navy had switched over to gas turbines and to diesel engines, there was no way of replenishing her and fueling her. And in fact, FFO is in decline as a fuel source throughout the merchant navies of the world. Very few vessels in the world now which are dependent upon heavy oil for propulsion. And so the whole point was you would have to have had her re-engined. And the cost of re-engineing her was about the same as building a new yacht. Now, that cost has been variously put, I think, Prime Minister Johnson has put it at 200 million. I suspect that's the bottom. That's the lower level of cost. Cost driver is probably not the hull and the new engines, but actually is the level of equipment inside the ship, because those luxury yachts which you see parked in the south of France, they spend many more times the price of building the bare hull on the interior furnishings of the ship. So, you know, 200 million, that's the southern figure. And I would suspect half a billion is more like the real cost of a new royal yacht. A hospital ship would cost less, I suggest, but we can discuss those details later if you want. Some people say, oh, well, the Navy would rather have a new frigate. Well, of course it would rather have a new frigate or an extra frigate, but it's not going to get an extra frigate out of any budget. This is not a question of having a frigate or a royal yacht. It's a question of having a royal yacht or not.
Right, but when you consider that warships like HMS Defender, which recently poked the Russians off the Crimea, are arguably underarmed and could do with having all that beefed up and are in fact waiting for missile systems to actually come along and be fitted, and we do have not enough warships to maintain all the normal commitments, would it not be a good idea to put some more capability into Defender or the Type 23s rather than have a royal yacht? Don't you think there's a validity to that argument?
But there's no balance sheet. It's not a question of royal yacht or extra equipment in Defender. It's not a question of royal yacht or another hull in the water. No one's doing those sums at all. So on the one hand, yes, I'd rather have ships which are better equipped. I'd rather have an extra ship or two or several, in fact. But no one's running a balance sheet which sets the Royal Yacht against greater capability in the Royal Navy. That's the whole problem. That's the weakness of this argument. The fear amongst naval officers is actually they'll get one frigate less if they have to pay for the Royal Yacht out of the naval budget.
Which brings us, of course, to another thorny topic, and one that's raised in the magazine by Commander Rob Forsyth, who's a former Polaris submarine XO from the Cold War, in that he argues that we shouldn't renew Trident and instead should spend that money on conventional warships and other things of a military nature that are not nuclear. And I would always say to him, and I have said to him in conversations, that while I would agree with the fact that the world needs to get rid of nuclear weapons and all the rest of it, I don't actually believe that politicians would devote any money saved from the deterrent to expanding the frigate force or the destroyers or buying, let's say, another class of Royal Fleet auxiliary support vessels. So do you think that's the same? That if you save money on that, you will not have it somewhere else?
Let's unpick that argument. I agree with what you say. I think while there are nuclear weapons, we should have our own deterrent. You can argue about how independent it is, but again, it's a separate argument. But we ought to have our own deterrent, and in our deterrent, we have a very skilled, very capable force. But if we were to get rid of Trident or its successor, it's cloud cuckoo land to think that that is going to be translated into more hulls and more equipment for the Royal Navy or for anybody else, frankly. You could argue that the submarines we've got are the wrong submarines. Odin has said, hasn't he, that maybe we should have a bigger fleet of conventional boats.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should buy them in from Sweden or Germany. That's Odin's view.
I suppose the argument is that if Britain doesn't start this process off and doesn't say, look, we're willing to give up these massively destructive ballistic missile submarines. So as an example to the rest of you, do you think other people would actually follow that example? Could we set that example to the rest of the world?
I don't think anybody would follow that example. And I think at the bottom of the line, we need that guarantee of our own safety and security.
But one thing the UK has invested in recent years and arguably is now paying off and features quite broadly in the other publication I'd like to talk to you about today is the carrier capability. And the Guide to the Royal Navy that has just been published has interviews with the bosses of the carrier air group, the strike group that's been sent around the world. And some people have compared that venture to the Great White Fleet, the American battle fleet that was sent on a defence diplomacy mission, as they would call it today, to go and fly the flag, make friends and influence people. So have we now reached a point in the Royal Navy's history where it's back in the game of doing that, influencing events and people and showing what the UK is capable of after a very, very sort of torrid time post-defence cuts? Do you think that the UK is back in that game?
Well, first of all, let me go back on your analogy of the Great White Fleet. I think the analogy is very good. The Great White Fleet announced the arrival of the Americans on the world stage. But one of the little lesser known facts about the Great White Fleet is it was dependent upon a smaller fleet of British colliers for good Welsh coal to enable it to steam around the world. And the parallel is here is the Royal Navy announcing its arrival back on the world stage. We're not using American colliers, but we are actually using American fighters in the carrier pro tem until we can build up to a proper strength of F-35s of our own. So that's a very good analogy for you to draw. Great White Fleet. Yep. I like that.
Well, we did have a piece in the mag from James Rogers about that very topic about 18 months ago. And so I can't say that I own it or that anybody owns it, to be honest, because obviously that was a very famous mission. But in terms of the American embarkation of strike jets and people in the carrier strike group, the UK carrier strike group, it isn't exactly unprecedented, though, is it? Did American aviators, did the Americans fly from British aircraft carriers in the past during World War II, for example?
In World War II, we lent a carrier to the Americans. She became the USS Robin. So when there was a gap in American capability after Pearl Harbor, we sent one of our carriers with our air group to fly with and fight for the Americans in the Pacific. Equally, during the war in the Mediterranean, in the 1940s, we borrowed American carriers to ferry aircraft to Malta. So this liaison between the two navies has a good historical precedent.
When it comes to, you mentioned the Pacific War there, when it comes to the vast arena of peace and war that is the Pacific, one of the key lessons of the Second World War, particularly at the end, was the need for an effective fleet train, an auxiliary force that could support a naval over vast distances with fuel, ammunition, spare parts and the rest of it. And we have an interview in the Guide to the Royal Navy with Commodore David Eagles, in addition to Commodore Steve Morehouse, the commander of the UK strike group, and Captain James Blackmore, who's the air wing commander. But separately, we talked to Commodore Eagles about the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, and that is an essential force that often gets overlooked. I mean, would you say that they are unjustly overlooked? Are they the backroom people that just don't get their share of the glory, would you say, in naval deployments?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. When we come to the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, I mean, it is a nice distinction that they fly the Blue Ensign and that they are manned fundamentally by the Merchant Navy, but they are in practice and capable warships, and they are necessary warships to enable the fleet to reach long distances, to resupply the fleet at sea, and to augment the fleet's capabilities with helicopters, anti-submarine weapons, some cases self-defense weapons. Arguably, some of these self-defense weapons have large capability. And their place in international law as merchant ships with self-defense armaments is well established. And they are, of course, as you quite rightly say, they're essential to the Navy's ability to sail the seven seas.
But one of the things I noticed during my time as a journalist writing about the Royal Navy on deployment in various places like the Gulf and the Adriatic was a tendency sometimes by politicians who maybe don't understand the niceties of the distinction between a merchant vessel that is also considered part of the Navy and flies the Blue Ensign and a proper warship with all the custom-built, tailor-made capabilities. They sometimes confuse, let's say, a fleet auxiliary. And I'm thinking here about the RFA Argus, which is the aviation training vessel of the Royal Fleet Auxiliary that was at one stage used almost as an auxiliary assault vessel in the Adriatic, on which were placed Royal Artillery guns and helicopters to stand by as an amphibious big deck carrier, as it were, to evacuate British troops potentially from Bosnia if the fighting erupted there. And I went aboard Argus, and I know that that vessel was uniquely suited to aviation training and also being a casualty reception ship, but was in no way fit for the job of hosting troops for any long time at all, for any endurance deployment off ashore. So do you think that sometimes there might be a danger in sending Royal Fleet Auxiliaries to do jobs that the Royal Navy's warships or specially built actual warships ought to do? And I'm thinking here of the way in which the auxiliary landing ships of today's fleet, the Bay-class vessels, are being pressed into action as littoral warfare vessels. So do you think there's sometimes a confusion there in the minds of politicians that you can just get a fleet auxiliary to jump in?
As regards the role in peacetime of Royal Fleet Auxiliaries, I think there's a sort of grey line between when you might want to use a warship with a white ensign and an auxiliary with a blue ensign. In peacetime, you can send one of the Bay class to the West Indies for disaster relief and take over the role of a frigate or a destroyer, which might have been used in previous generations as the so-called guard ship in the West Indies. And then the blurred line becomes in operations like you describe in the Adriatic. And so long as the ships stand off far enough and are not exposed to too high a degree of danger or counterattack, I think it's acceptable, both by politicians and by senior naval officers, to use RFAs in that kind of role. Always bearing in mind, there is a very careful legal distinction between a armed ship in government service and a merchant ship armed defensively. A distinction which hasn't always been regarded throughout history, but nevertheless is firmly established in international law.
I think in that case, I agree with everything you say there. What was grimly evident aboard RFA Argus was the fact that her, shall we say, sewage system couldn't cope with troops for a long time. And in fact, I was taken to one side by one of the army officers aboard who was absolutely incandescent with the fact that the living conditions aboard were terrible. And so at one stage, Argus had to be taken off station and sent to Ancona for the maritime equivalent of Dynarod to clear out her pipes because of the heavy traffic of all the troops. So I suppose there's another side to that as well, that if you're going to compromise between what we call merchant ship standards and warship standards, then you can stray into this area where you create a vessel that needs either additional work to make it fit for purpose or one that's just totally unsuited due to the things like accommodation and dealing with the, shall we say, the sewage flow.
That's very interesting, but I don't think you can argue from the particular to the general. Arguably, she was the wrong ship being used for the wrong purpose. And in another war, at another time, we might have taken up a passenger ship or a cruise liner, a stuff taken up from trade and used her for troop accommodation. I think your soldier friend was a bit short-sighted. I bet the accommodation on board the RFA was a great deal better than in his slit trench in some damp valley in Albania or Yugoslavia, wherever it was. Though it wouldn't have been as good as the five-star hotel that the RAF would have been using.
Oh, I think that's a scurrilous suggestion, Peter. How do you suggest that the RAF would ever stay in a hotel in preference for some grey warship on the ocean wave? So do you think that the Royal Navy is now recovered from the harm inflicted on it by the 2010 Strategic Defence Review? Do you think it's recovered from that, or is there still work to be done?
The 2010 Defence Review was a disaster for the Royal Navy. Getting rid of the carriers and the harriers in that review was extraordinarily short-sighted. It was taken for political reasons. Has the Royal Navy recovered from the disastrous defence review of 2010? Not yet. It's well on the road to recovery. And as the present First Sea Lord himself has said, there are several classes of new ships coming down the pipeline. I can only hope that they will be launched, built and launched in sufficient numbers to help the Navy recover its position and to be able to undertake the global tasks.
Well, as you know, Peter, across the years that you and I have worked on Warships IFR magazine, we've always looked at global fleets. And it's interesting you mention the new frigates for the Royal Navy that are coming to service, which, of course, are based on a Danish class of flexible frigate. And in fact, the UK is now thinking that it might try and sell the Type 31 frigate, as the British version of that Danish vessel is called, to the Hellenic Navy, the Greek fleet. So do you think across time, certainly modern times, there's been a great deal of borrowing of warship designs, and that actually the UK should do more of it, buy in more and use those designs where they're proven, and such as the Type 31 being based on a Danish frigate?
Yes. I used to be the military assistant to the Deputy Chief of Defence Staff Assistance, a general. And I can remember years ago now when the something called the Anglo-French Future Frigate, the AFFF, was under discussion. And the Navy hadn't even decided whether it wanted a anti-air warfare ship or an anti-submarine warfare ship. The significance of that is one purpose, you need a V-shaped hull, and for the other, you need a U-shaped hull. And after a French admiral had called on my general and opened these negotiations about the possible cooperation between the French and the British about this new class of ship, this class of ship became our Type 45. But after this first meeting, the general sent for me and he said, "Peter, what's going on here?" So I had to try and explain to him and summarize for him in a couple of minutes what we've been discussing over the previous hour or so. And I can remember the general taking his glasses off and leaning back in his chair, and he said to me, "But what's wrong with your usual methods?" And I said, "Well, sir, you know, if it's an international program like this, and it's a very European program, and it'll have more stickability, and we can share the research costs and everything else." "No, no, no, boy, you don't understand. What's wrong with your usual methods?" I said, "General, which bit of my argument explanation do you not understand?" He said, "Well, my boy, they build them and you capture them."
Like the Napoleonic Wars.
Exactly. Yeah. But the principle is what I'm getting at here. Of course, we should take the best ideas from other navies. And if you remember, Odin was one of the first people to write about the virtues of this Danish class, the Absalom class. As long ago as 2005, I think, Odin was writing about the virtue and versatility of these ships. And goodness me, here we are. Is that 16 years later? We've come to realize that this class of ship has, you know, this type of ship has some utility, some usefulness for us. Great. And I fully endorse the idea that we should capture good ideas from other navies.
Well, that's a little bit different, I suppose, from cooperating with people trying to decide amongst various nations what you need to have in your ship. Because I well remember when the magazine was starting out, going to see an Italian destroyer which was taking to see representatives of the nations involved in the Future Destroyer program. That's obviously Italy and France and the UK. And it was great. It was a great social event. There was some wonderful food because it's an Italian warship. But at the end of the day, what happened was the three navies decided they couldn't really agree which way to go, apart from maybe the weapon system and a general look that's the same, and maybe some of the radar and other things. So buying in a Type 31 frigate, i.e. the Iver Huitfeldt, I think I've pronounced it right, class frigate from Denmark, is a little bit different from sitting down in a room with three other nations or two other nations and saying, can we please agree what our future destroyer is? So will that ever happen, do you think? Will the UK actually ever, especially after Brexit, join up with our European partners and design a future warship? Give a polite answer.
Could we buy in a ship? Well, I've already suggested in this podcast that we should perhaps buy in, hire, charter some conventional boats from Sweden or Germany in order to police our own waters. I personally would see no problem in buying in a class of ship. And you were talking about the Danish Absalon class. I remember, again, that Odin noted how much cheaper they were to build in Denmark. So there's a strong argument for saying that some of these ships could perhaps be built abroad, but I suspect that politically that would never be acceptable.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. It does go back in time that the UK has in the past not worried, in terms of submarines certainly, about buying in new technology. The Holland class were American origin.
I think in the past we've had an open mind to this, but I suspect that it would be very difficult just to announce we're going to buy a whole ship from the Danes or anybody else, frankly.
When it comes to the small ships of the Royal Navy, there have been new additions to the fleet, and those are recorded in the Guide to the Royal Navy. And I wonder, do you think they're playing a more prominent role in long-range deployments? And is it well-advised or ill-advised? How do you view it?
If you went to Singapore and looked at the equivalent patrol boat used for similar purposes, you get a heavily armed, well-built ship. And I think in this case, we are guilty of over-egging the pudding. You know, it's a disgrace that, these 30-year-old, they were originally called the P-2000s, 30-year-old ships should be listed in the Navy's order of battle. They need to be replaced, and they need to be replaced by well-armed ships with a capability which could be found in other navies. And in this case, I cite the Singaporean Navy.
Well, of course, there's a distinction between the plastic patrol boats, the P-2000s that you're talking about, and also Magpie, which is, in essence, a replacement for Gleaner, the smallest survey ship in the Navy, and the new River-class Batch 2s, which are being sent around the world, the Caribbean, the Falklands, out to Asia, Indo-Pacific. And they need to be ready for the kind of enemy they might face, for the kind of circumstances they'll face in a darkening and a worsening global naval scene. But I suppose there always will be a place for the small vessel, the Magpies of this world, to do the inshore charts, and also the patrol vessels, the P-2000s, which can take students out on future naval officers, shall we say, out on experience voyages at sea. But I think the mistake, it's a bit like we discussed a little while ago about the fleet auxiliaries, the mistake that happens is when, as you say, people over-egg the pudding and they try to suggest that small fiberglass auxiliary patrol boats or survey vessels are actually part of the order of battle, when in fact what we're dealing with today, you know, the Cold War is over, all hail the new Cold War, which could turn hot at any moment. What we're dealing with today are massively expanding potential enemy fleets. And I make no bones about it, the Russians, the Chinese, and potentially the Iranians are, you know, they're not up there with them, but they're building all sorts of vessels. So I suppose what would worry me is not so much that we have those small craft in the Royal Navy's order of battle, and they deserve their small listing in our esteemed guide, but that we mistake those vessels, as you say, for being able to survive and fight in environments where they'll just be destroyed instantly, or where they won't be able to handle even normal coastal tasks like counter-terrorism or fishery protection, or be able to protect themselves if facing even a minor foe. So I guess I would agree with you on that, and I suppose that's what you're saying.
Yeah, yes, these patrol vessels, I mean, the river class, okay, it's terrific to send them out on some global mission, but they will be, and they perform a useful function, presence, but they're expendable. And they will be wiped out by almost any moderate navy in the literal waters of the world, because they don't have enough weapon systems, they don't have enough capability. And I'm really afraid that naval officers might deceive themselves too. You mentioned it yourself earlier on about this distinction between the Blue Ensign RFA and the White Ensign warship. There is a blurred line between their different functions, and there's a real risk here that, never mind politicians, that senior naval officers will mistake these patrol vessels for ships that should be in the order of battle.
Well, what they would say about the River-class Batch 2, of course, is that they have the same command and control capabilities, and they can be fitted with weapon systems and probably adapted. But, of course, as you and I know, any future war, and this is something that we touch on in the Guide to the Royal Navy, for any future war would be both catastrophic in scale, but also short and sharp. So it's a bit like the lifeboat party. If you know, you have to go with what you've got. You abandon ship, or you leap into that conflict with what you're wearing. So the idea that you can actually have a patrol ship that will do a vital function, an important function in peace, as you say, flying the flag, training Ukrainians, or showing a security presence off the Channel Islands is great. And promising that it can take Royal Marines and or, you know, other capabilities, let's say, of a more naval aspect, because it has the command and control, is something that I personally would be worried about if we're being serious about being possibly involved in facing the Chinese or the Russians in a war setting. Because, of course, you can't call them back. You won't have time to fit them out. And fitted for but not with is not going to be good enough when your conflict springs up out of nowhere and then lasts about 10 days or 5 days. So to me, that's the big problem. Fitted for but not with. And that extends to, I suppose, other warships that are bigger than that as well.
I'm not going to argue with that analysis too far. We could discuss for a long time whether the war is going to be long or short. But in the case of the River Class, Batch 2, the war is not going to last more than 10 days because these ships do not have credibility. You're quite right. There won't be time to call them back to re-equip them. And they will, in the face of, let's say, one of these ships in the Indian Ocean, in the so-called String of Pearls, the islands around India, which mark the areas of influence between the Indian Navy and the Chinese Navy, one of those ships would be incapable of intervening in any meaningful sense whatsoever. And were it to be there, no matter how good a command system, it would be overwhelmed. That's my concern. So you've lost your first soldier. You've lost your first battle, and it's quite difficult to recover from that.
The thing that would be said to you would be that these things, warships, steel warships, don't really matter or really won't matter in the future so much as they do today, because we have drones, and we'll have big drones and small drones. And so these vessels will only be platforms for, let's say, an undersea craft that is basically a robot submarine, or an aircraft that is a robot platform for carrying bombs or supplies or carrying out surveillance. So are we on the cusp, as we examine in the guide and constantly in the actual magazine, are we on the cusp of replacing traditional warships and capabilities anytime soon, do you think? Is it happening now? Are we there?
The whole question of drones is really interesting. They're much more capable, or will be much more capable than they are today. But we don't have many yet. We're on the cusp of a change, but they haven't arrived yet. I can see, for instance, that HMS Queen Elizabeth, if we were to have this conversation in 25 years' time, she would be equipped with a fleet of drones of various sizes. I can see that even the smaller warships might be fitted with surveillance or weapon-carrying drones of enormous range and capability. But we're not yet there. And while I see interesting experiments by Royal Marines, as well as in minesweeping, we have some way to go yet. And we have yet to see the investment and to see those weapon systems in production. Now, where I suspect we are in terms of development is of drones is somewhere about the 1890s, when you may recall that a politician said that the design and shape of warships changed like ladies change their hats. Okay, hats aren't very fashionable these days.
No.
But the principle is the same, is that drones are developing very quickly. They can be adapted very quickly. And in 10, 20 years' time, they will have developed fully, and we will have an impressive array of drones around us. You can quite see that even a small ship could carry an array of drones with long endurance, which will increase its surveillance range and will increase its weapons range. But it's not yet there. The fashions are still changing rapidly.
So basically, if the Royal Navy, the modern Royal Navy, the new Royal Navy that has vessels coming into service can manage to avoid, and if the world can manage to avoid, let's face it, we don't want to be involved in any conflicts at all. But, you know, the scene, the international naval scene, geopolitical scene is getting more tricky every day. If the world can avoid it, then by the time any likely potential flashpoint that could lead to war comes along, then if they can survive long enough, in other words, if we can have peace long enough, then vessels like the River Class Batch 2 and the new frigates, etc., will have, and the new mine warfare capability as well, will have those drones and those abilities to hopefully deter a potential enemy. But it takes time, and as you said, it's like people changing their hats. History does have lessons to offer. You can't take them as blueprints, as being set in stone that something will happen again like that. So the trick is to pick up the key elements of whatever the lesson of history is, and then adapt them and then evolve, and bear in mind that you don't want to repeat the past mistakes. Do you think that we're repeating past mistakes, that we're, for example, sending these vessels out, as you say, to Singapore, to out that way, and we're making them exposed? And if we don't have the presence there of bigger and beefier warships to work with the patrol vessels, we could end up with something a bit like Force Z, for example, a politician sending an ill-configured group of warships out to try and deter something that it would never be able to do.
I think we're taking enormous risks, and I hope those risks are calculated. To pay for the carriers, we lost frigate and destroyer hulls, but we lost a great deal of expertise in our naval aviation, which we're having to relearn at great cost and trouble. And we're taking risks again. Now, historically, our risk taking has been moderately good. But if you want to look at previous wars, then we have been caught out from time to time by not being ready and not being prepared. So long as the risks we are taking are known and we are taking them consciously, that's okay. That's a lesson from history which we can take. But I fear that we're not being too honest with ourselves about those risks. And you talk about war. Well, I think we're at war now. Various degrees of war with the Russians, with the Chinese. It may not manifest itself yet in conflicts at sea, but we're only one step away from some kind of miscalculation. In my own experience, I, in the 1990s, was the head of defense studies, and I had a part in the so-called Ruckus talks. They were originally called Adderbury, but the Ruckus talks were confidence-building talks between Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. We learned from each other about the risks we were taking when our ships met at sea. The mechanisms which we developed during the Ruckus talks stood the test of time for about 10 years, until Russia became more irredentist under Putin and more challenging at sea, more aggressive. And you can see, can't you, in the recent deployment to the Black Sea, it would only have required a small miscalculation for some harm, some damage to have been done. So, A, I say that we're at war. B, I say that the confidence building measures that we had developed and no longer in place. And C, I think we are taking risks on a daily basis. And for that, we need ships which are capable now, not capable if we make this investment or that investment, or if we bring them home and rearm them in 5 or 10 years' time.
I think that's a very good point you just made about the mechanisms for ensuring that hot war does not happen. But I think to realise that you need the mechanisms to stop hot war that could happen at any moment with a miscalculation. As you say, HMS Defender's deployment in the Black Sea showed how close that could come. I think you need to know and realise that that is actually the game that you're in. That is actually the deadly game that you're in. And that therefore you must have these mechanisms. Both you and I, Peter, have written books about various naval history topics, various eras, various ages. And I've done at least one book that delved into the Cold War. And you talked about those mechanisms. And during the Cold War, there certainly were those mechanisms. And I cannot imagine, for example, there would ever have been this, what seems to me, slightly insane race to put weaponry in space during the Cold War. And I think we had an agreement there, a tacit agreement there between the East and the West to talk first before the missiles started flying. And actually, the main thing we needed to do was never launch the missiles, rather than, as we're doing today, think about if they launch, how do we shoot them down? So I think in the past, the lesson of history there that we've both absorbed is that you do need talk, you do need negotiation, and you definitely need open lines of communication. And in a slightly strange segue, I think one of the things that you've alighted on in your latest book, which looks at communications and how it can be pivotal in warfare, or shall we say in listening into or detecting the foe's communications, is the ability to put out there a technological edge that enables wireless transmissions to be used against an enemy. And your latest book looks at an often, shall we say, ignored side of the Second World War at sea. So could you tell us a little bit more about that and a special event that has just been held in London connected to it?
Yes, I've just written the history of the Wrens and the Y service. The Y service was a secret listening service in World War II. The Wrens were a specially recruited group of about 400 women, an elite group of women, who could speak German and capture, take down rapidly Morse. And they were an essential part of our victory in the war at sea. They were listening to HF Morse and sending their, what they'd captured, their intelligence take off to Bletchley Park. But even more importantly, they were listening to German, Italian, and later on Japanese voice, and they were inputting their information directly into local intelligence centers. And these women had an influence. I mean, it's sad that their roles haven't been recorded before. It's almost too late, because I've only been able to interview half a dozen surviving 90-year-old veterans. But they had an influence on the hunt for the Bismarck. They had an influence, or they would have had an influence if they'd been listened to, on the Channel Dash. Yeah. They took part throughout the war in the E-boat war in the southern North Sea and in the English Channel. And they were there at the Battle of Matapan, giving vital intelligence to Cunningham. And also a famous incident at the end of the war, the sinking of the Japanese heavy cruiser Haguru. If you read the classic stories, for example, of the hunt and the sinking for the Haguru, it was a classic destroyer action at night, when these ships hunted down this Japanese ship. But what nobody has told you until today, of course, until I've written this, written and researched this history, is actually the Wrens listening in Colombo played an essential part in finding that ship, giving the intelligence where to go and look and how to attack it.
And do you think that's true that in all the cases that they were able to provide some kind of tactical or strategic effect, that they've been unsung? Has it not been mentioned anywhere at all that they might have had a bearing on other things?
The role of this elite group of 400 Wrens is, you can't say it's been forgotten, because it's never been remembered, and they are totally unsung.
Well, I have to say, thanks to you and your discoveries, and also mentioning my most recent book and another one I've got coming out, I've been able to get in some mentions. Firstly, in the latest Bismarck book I've done, Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom, the 80th anniversary edition, and also a forthcoming paperback of HMS London, which looks at an officer's career idea, something else you helped me with. And he took part in the destroyer action that sank the Hoguro. And I've got to say thanks very much to you highlighting that, because I got them a mention in that.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. But there has been an event in London where you've actually managed to gather some of the surviving Wrens together. I believe, and you've actually been able to meet them and discuss with them and their relatives all the amazing things they've done. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, I was able, post-lockdown, to hold a book launch in London. And for that, I got a couple of these ancient ladies, ancient girls, I'd call them that, because actually when you're talking to them, they are remembering the events of their late teens and their early 20s, when they had a lot of girlish fun, I have to say.
Right.
And they're remembering those events. I had a couple of them there, including the famous Pat Davies, who spoke extremely well. She's 98 years old. She can remember these incidents very clearly. I also got together the survivors from the torpedoing of the Empress of Canada. There were six of these girls coming home after 3 years' service in the Far East. They had been evacuated from Singapore just before the Japanese arrived. They'd been evacuated from Colombo after the Easter Day raid of 1942. These Wrens, the Y Service Wrens, gave a warning of the Easter Day raid on Colombo, enabling Leighton and Somerville to sail their ships to the west and avoid a second Pearl Harbor. That's a hugely important incident in naval history. Anyway, these six girls were evacuated from Colombo to Mombasa. And then after 3 years' service in the Indian Ocean, they were on their way home in the Empress of Canada when she was torpedoed in the Atlantic. And they had a really rough 4 days on the equator in rafts before they were rescued.
Crikey.
And I was able to bring together the descendants of the surgeon who'd swum between the rafts to give first aid, the descendants of Pamela Luke, who survived one of the longest periods on a raft in the water, and of Elizabeth Bonner, who had been one of the nurses who'd taken charge of one of the lifeboats and rendered invaluable services to the survivors. And I got these women together, these descendants together, for the first time.
Oh, that must have been brilliant.
Actually, I'm rather hoping there's going to be a new book out of it.
Ah, right. Well, you have to tell us more about that later. But what the name of your book, what is the name of your current book?
The book is Bletchley Park's Secret Source, Churchill's Wrens and the Y Service.
Brilliant.
And it's a bestseller.
It is a bestseller. Well, that's great as well. So you'll be able to put your feet up soon and not have to write any more books, Peter.
Very funny. Yeah.
If you could give up the addiction, that is.
Yes, yeah. If you could give up the addiction, just right here.
Yeah. So it's been great to talk to you, Peter, about things in the August edition and also one or two projects you've been working on in the background, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, Warships is a 12 editions a year magazine and never ceases in its rotation through the deadlines and the production. And even as we're talking about this, the August edition, the September edition is launched, and the cover star of the September edition is a Russian Akula 2 class nuclear powered submarine in the Baltic, looking amazing, with actually a rainbow breaking over the bows of this attack submarine as it sails north towards Kronstadt and St. Petersburg. And that's a story that we've called on the front cover, Russia's missile boat message to NATO. And then we've got a feature in there on China spying on a big exercise off Australia, and one or two other things, such as maritime choke points being under threat. And also Odin is back, giving us another cutting and insightful commentary on the situation in the Baltic and how the Germans and the current US government may have undermined security and, in fact, have outraged some of the Eastern European Western allies with the pursuit of a Baltic pipeline. So that's Odin's topic this time. And there's all sorts of other things in there, like the latest on the UK carrier strike group. And in terms of news, something on the drone strike, allegedly by the Iranians, on a tanker off Oman. So that's all in the September edition, which is out now. And it has never ceased, has it, Peter, over 23 years? The naval scene has got busier and busier. The topics have got more epic and awesome in terms of their scale and their potential for trouble around the world, and also the technological developments. So it was good to have you in the mix as well. And in particular, I wonder, as somebody who can speak Swedish and has friends in the Baltic And obviously, I consulted you with a bit of insight on what we were doing on Russia's activities there in various editions. So what do you think is the situation in the Baltic at the moment? Just to give us a quick taste of how the naval scene is there.
I think the situation in the Baltic is very fraught. The Russians are obviously in an expansive mood. They've got bases and depots on Gotland and in the southeast corner of Sweden, which are allegedly just bases to support the pipeline. The pipeline is going to circumvent and undermine the economic position of Poland and the Ukraine. It's going to give the Russians a stranglehold on German energy supplies. And it's going to change the geopolitics and geostrategic situation in the Baltic. I'm slightly less concerned about Russian nuclear submarines going to St. Petersburg, bearing in mind that the water's generally so shallow they can't operate there.
No, I can't dive. No.
The news that's broken since, of course, that the Oscar II broke down as it was redeploying out of the Baltic and nearly drifted ashore in Denmark.
Right.
That's a bit of embarrassment for them.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Which might indicate to us the condition of those boats. I am more concerned about Russian irredentism, you know, large ethnic Russian minorities in the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. The enclave in Kaliningrad,
yeah,
which is an existential threat to security. And simply, we don't have enough forces in the Baltic to countermand them. I'm encouraged by, you know, the initiative that Britain has taken to form up a group of nations, of northern nations, which is an extra NATO organization. So it includes Sweden,
yeah,
which might, you know, present or indicate our resolve not to let the Russians get away with everything, not to let them get away with a power grab in the Baltic or in the Baltic states or in the Arctic, which is another area
it is
where the Russians are showing their muscle.
Crucial importance, yeah. Well, there's obviously something in there that Odin holds forth on, and he gives a slightly different perspective on that. And we do have a report with some more amazing imagery from Michael Nitz, who's based in Germany, who took the cover shot, and also others of Russian submarines and warships. So that's part of the offering in the September edition, along with also some naval history. There's some fresh angles on the loss of the American submarine Thresher in the 1960s, which have just come out, which is a fascinating dive into that by one of our writers. And also a look at a little known vessel which supported flying boats during the Second World War. So we've got a bit of history in there, which is suitable, I guess, for our magazine. And you have contributed to that too. So I'd just like to thank you for coming on the podcast today, and brilliant to have you here, Peter.
My pleasure. It's always been a great pleasure to work with you, Ian, and I think the magazine goes from strength to strength, and long may it do so.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to the Warships International Fleet Review podcast. If you'd like to obtain the magazine itself, please visit your local newsagent and pick one up from the shelf. Or, if you like, ask them if they can order it in. Alternatively, visit the Warships IFR website, warshipsifr.com, and you can obtain it that way. You can subscribe to get a hard copy each month direct to you wherever you are in the world, or get a digital edition. You can connect with us via Warships IFR on Facebook. That's at Warships IFR. Very easy to remember. Follow us on Twitter on at Warships IFR, or check out our amazing videos of warships themselves on YouTube, which is called Warships IFR TV. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.